Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. President Obama, flush with the confidence from a string of recent high points and successes, is returning to an issue he has often spoken about. It's an issue that stands behind many of the community unrest stories around the country that the president has observed, commented upon, and tried to correct during his presidency by encouraging better relations between citizens and the police, between African Americans and the criminal justice system. The president commuted the sentences of 46 drug offenders on Monday. Most had been sentenced to at least 20 years. 14 of them had life without parole. President Obama has now commuted more sentences than any other president since Lyndon Johnson. And today, the president toured El Reno Federal Correctional Institution near Oklahoma City.
You know, visiting with these six individuals, you know, I've said this before, when they describe their youth and their childhood, these are young people who made mistakes that aren't that different than the mistakes I made and the mistakes that a lot of you guys make. The difference is they did not have the kinds of support structures, the second chances, the resources that would allow them to survive those mistakes.
That's the president speaking from the Big House, El Reno Correctional Facility. Earlier today, he's the first sitting president to visit a federal prison. On Tuesday, the president spoke about the unfair sentences given to nonviolent drug offenders, a good percentage of them poor and African-American. This was his message to the NAACP and the nation.
If you're a low-level drug dealer or you violate your parole, you owe some debt to society. You have to be held accountable and make amends. But you don't owe 20 years. You don't owe a life sentence. That's disproportionate to the price that should be paid. And by the way, the taxpayers are picking up the tab for that price.
This renewed emphasis on criminal justice reform comes with another surprise. Republicans and Democrats have found rare common ground on this issue. Joining us is Mark Levin, director of the Center for Effective Justice at the Texas Public Policy Foundation and policy director of Right on Crime. Welcome, Mark.
Well, thank you for having me.
Do you buy the president's sense that this is a bipartisan issue, that there's common ground?
Oh, absolutely. And in fact, I think what's led up to this, frankly, is states, mostly conservative states, happen to have, in most cases, Republican governors, have passed, in some cases unanimously, major criminal justice reform, including drug sentencing reform. So you're looking at states like Georgia, South Carolina, Texas, Mississippi, Alabama. And so there's tremendous momentum behind this. And of course, in Congress, you've got senators like Rand Paul, Ted Cruz, in the House, Jason Chaffetz, James Sensenbrenner, many Republicans who are pushing this, along with many Democrats in Congress. So it is one of those rare moments in Washington where gridlock could actually be broken.
Mark Levin, it wasn't so long ago that Texas was, if I'm not mistaken, the biggest prison builder in the world.
That's correct. In the 90s, Texas built tens of thousands of prisons, but we really hit a turning point in 2007 where we had, at that point, 156,000 prison beds, and we had a projection from our state government that does those projections that we would need to build another 17,000 prison beds at a cost of a few billion dollars to build and operate by 2012. So this was 2007. But instead, we decided to expand our drug courts, expand treatment beds for mental health and substance abuse, and also halfway houses for people that were waiting to be paroled. So this has resulted in a 12% drop in our incarceration rate. At the same time, the crime rate's down 24%, and in many other states have had similar experiences.
Mark, now how do we get from the Willie Horton days of law and order and fear of criminals and people in prison to this period right now where we're talking about rehab, we're talking about drug courts, we're talking about all kinds of procedures that make prison a last resort, not a first resort?
Yeah, and of course, we still have a lot of ways to go, including in Texas and many other states, and obviously at the federal level. But as you know, there's some excellent legislation pending in Congress, the SAFE Act, the Corrections Act. There's bills that deal with specific aspects such as reining in mandatory minimums for low-level drug offenders, earned time for inmates who complete programs that can reduce recidivism. But I think that if you look at it, the public's been ahead of the politicians. I mean, you can go back to 1996 in Arizona when voters voted to say you couldn't go to prison for your first two low-level drug possession offenses. This was a ballot initiative in Arizona in 1996. So unfortunately, though, sometimes this issue in the past has been mischaracterized in 30-second radio ads or bumper stickers. So it does take looking at the evidence. And, you know, frankly, now we've seen Governor Kasich and Governor Deal campaign on reducing incarceration. Governor Deal in Georgia sent out a mail piece talking about a 20% reduction in black incarceration in Georgia over the last few years, which is true. So I think that we don't care who gets the credit or about the politics of it, but if good policy makes good politics, that's all the better.
We don't care who gets the credit after he just reels off a list of like eight Republicans, some of whom are running for president. Mark Levin, you're a good salesperson here on the Republican side.
Well, let me say,
I think that's totally legitimate.
Yeah. There are states like Connecticut that have done amazing reforms. It's certainly not just Republicans. And I'll tell you an interesting thing about Ohio. Governor Strickland, a Democrat, when he was governor, started the justice reinvestment process. And then Governor Kasich, it never came up in the election. They both agreed on it. But when Governor Kasich took over, he continued it on. I think, you know, to be fair, sometimes it's perhaps harder for some Democrats because of the history of things like, you know, Michael Dukakis. So I think it's easier in some ways for Republicans to lead on this because of the historically the public hasn't trusted Democrats, perhaps because of they're more likely to be opposed to the death penalty, which really doesn't have anything to do with how many people are in prison. So I do think that the Republicans come in with a bit of an advantage just because of historical reasons.
That's interesting because I referred to Willie Horton a moment ago. And again, yes, that was an intimidating tactic that in many ways may have derailed the Dukakis candidacy for president. But you know, are Republicans going to run on this issue in 2016? Do you see it, or is it something that's going to be in the background that everyone agrees on, and we're going to have this reform without a lot of rhetoric?
Well, that's a great question. You know, one of the reasons we have this window of opportunity is that crime's been going down for 20 years in a row. So there's a sense in which we don't wish for it to be the number one issue on the front burner. If you look at polls of what issues that people are most concerned about, much higher is foreign policy, healthcare, education, taxes. So I think that that reflects the fact that crime has gone down for two decades in a row. So there's a balancing act there, but I do think there are those candidates who face tough general elections in 2016. There is an interest in the sense that this can expand into various candidates' constituency and show that they're truly a problem solver. They're not just part of the gridlock and part of the problem.
Well, this is potentially an innovation zone in terms of public policy because what we've learned, it seems, and, you know, tell me if I'm wrong, if you don't agree, that, you know, just writing off 2 million people or 4 million, if you include the people who are on parole, up to 6 million, if you include all the people on parole and who are incarcerated, you can't just write them off. You may say that they've made terrible mistakes and that they should be punished for that if they're convicted of crimes, but they still are around. They still have to have a place in society, and we have to figure out a place for them. And that means educational programs. That means, you know, allowing them to get jobs without carrying this scourge of being a convict around. Are Republicans going to support those kinds of jobs? Because those do relate to issues that people care about, like tension between law enforcement and racial groups in our cities, the Ferguson story, all the kinds of things that have been in the headlines for the last year and a half.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you, one of the main issues is the fact that people have the scarlet letter, a lifetime record of a conviction. So in Texas this year, we passed legislation to say for the first time, if you have a conviction, you can get an order of nondisclosure that seals your record. And you can say when you apply for jobs, you weren't convicted. Now, it's still visible to prosecutors and law enforcement and some agencies that deal with very sensitive licensing. But I think that's Minnesota and Indiana have passed similar bills over the last few years. And the REDEEM Act, which does this, is pending in Congress. So people are realizing that if you made a mistake when you were 18, you had shoplifting or marijuana possession, things like that, to have that still be on your record when you're 70 years old, it doesn't make any sense. And it actually increases recidivism because people can't find a job, they can't rent an apartment and so forth.
Mark Levin is director of the Center for Effective Justice at the Texas Public Policy Foundation. He's policy director of Right on Crime. Mark, thanks so much.
Well, thank you.
The fact that the judge gave him a $10,000 bail, the fact that the district attorney decided to prosecute him and hold him in jail for 3 years. What were they thinking about this young man, 16-year-old kid, accused of stealing a backpack? What were they thinking when they ordered him for $10,000 bail, when they put him in Rikers Island? What were they thinking?
Some of the heartbreaking details of the story of Kalief Browder, a young man who committed suicide after being held for 3 years on Rikers Island before ever facing a trial. It all started with a bail he could not afford to pay. Next week, we'll focus on six words in the Constitution. Excessive bail shall not be required. Those six words begin the Eighth Amendment, and they help us begin a series that looks at the complicated, highly politicized, and often abused practice of bail. What is bail? What's fair bail? What are the procedures? How can the system of bail strip you of your freedom before you ever get to the trial that you've been promised by the Constitution? We'll hear from Kenny Fombi, who at 19 years old was arrested and charged for a crime he did not commit. His bail was set at $2 million, and he spent 6 months in jail.
I could not control my future, and the basic American dream to me was a ransom of $2 million.
We'll also hear from Cliff Keenan, director of the Pretrial Services Agency for the District of Columbia. D.C. is one of the few places that has completely eliminated money bail, and instead, those who are considered too risky to release are held on what is called preventive detention.
This is a quote from Robert Kennedy over 50 years ago. What has been made clear today is that our present attitudes towards bail are not only cruel, but really completely illogical. What has been demonstrated here is that usually only one factor determines whether a defendant stays in jail before he comes to trial. That factor is not guilt or innocence. It is not the nature of the crime. It is not the character of the defendant. That factor is simply money. How much money does the defendant have?
That's all next week in our series we call Presumption of Innocence for Sale on The Takeaway.